John Hile is Professor of Philosophy at Washington University in St. Louis. He works primarily in metaphysics and philosophy of mind. He's the author of The Universe as We Find It, published in 2012 by Oxford University Press, and Philosophy of Mind, A Contemporary Introduction, published in 2012 by Routledge. He is listed among the 50 most influential living philosophers by thebestschools.org. Consciousness is a primary phenomenological experience that is encountered by any cognitive human mind, leaving the aspects of a potential artificial intelligence down the road, leaving that aspect aside. But consciousness has been a contentious issue historically. It's got a long philosophical tradition. In the 20th century, it's slightly moved more to the area of proper objective scientific study. By that, I mean the discipline of neuroscience, which really tries to study the brain itself as a material entity, which could then give rise to a conscious experience. That's also caused a lot of contentious debate in philosophy of mind as well, because some aspects of that overlap and then some are distinctly different. But from your position as a philosopher of mind, how would you define consciousness itself?
Well, I'm not clear how useful definitions are in these cases. In fact, I suspect that any definition of mind or consciousness or any of these basic things is going to be impossible to understand unless you already know what minds and consciousness and so on are. But to have sort of a go at it, I guess I think of minds as what we appeal to in accounting for the behavior of living creatures, creatures that need to solve problems in pursuit of ends that they have or they value themselves. So we're likely to attribute a mind to any living creature we regard as behaving intelligently. I mean, and this is why when we have machines that seem to be behaving intelligently, it seems natural to take over mental categories in describing them. Now, consciousness, I mean, there's the ordinary sense of consciousness, which I take to be something like perceptually aware. I mean, I think when people wonder whether someone or something is conscious, they wonder whether the thing is perceptually aware. And it might or might not be in a position to respond to that perceptual awareness. So questions arise of whether paralyzed people, we think they can still be conscious even if they can't respond. I think philosophers extend this idea of consciousness beyond the perceptual to things like dreams and bodily sensations, hallucinations, and so on. So I think the philosophical conception of consciousness is probably somewhat broader than the everyday sense of consciousness that people have in mind when they appeal to it or wonder about it.
Moving on to the mind-body problem, again, another salient historical issue, just to give a generalized umbrella term, it's the problem between obviously the mind and the physical body that always seems to, at least in nature, accompany the human mind. Obviously, this has had many contentious issues throughout history. Obviously, dualism from Descartes to someone in the extreme modern movement, someone like the Churchlands or Daniel Dennett, that would have a more reductionist approach that literally the mind just is the brain, and a lot of people think that way as well. The idea that not just that the mind is the brain, but perhaps this kind of first person subjective experience is an illusion. Now, that's just a rough general overview, but from your expertise, how would you best sum up the mind-body problem?
Well, actually, I think there are two mind-body problems. There's first the problem of how consciousness comes about, right? So what's the relation that minds bear to bodies? So are minds and bodies separate entities, as Descartes thought, or are they just brains? Are minds just brains? Or are minds somehow produced by but not identifiable with brains? So that's one of the mind-body problems. The other one is the traditional problem of how minds and bodies could interact causally. And your answer to that is going to depend on, or your approach to that is going to depend on your answer to the first question. So if you thought, for example, that minds were just brains and mental states were just brain states, there's really no problem about causal interaction. But if you were a Cartesian, thought that minds were completely separate from brains, then there is the issue of how they could causally interact. And if you thought, again, that consciousness is somehow produced, as Searle likes to say, by the nervous system, then the question again arises, so how can mental states interact with physical states if they're produced by them? And it's not that these questions are unanswerable, it's just that the kind of answer you give is going to depend on how you're thinking about the relation that mind, spirit to body in the first place.
With that in mind, you've given two subcategories of the overarching mind-body problem. Depending on what position you might take, obviously, within some of your responses, obviously, you could spit out further. If you're a property dualist or a substance dualist, that will be one issue. But regardless of whichever subcategory you pick, I'm sure this is related to the following question, which is, to what extent is the mind-body problem even valid?
It's certainly possible that the mind-body problem stems from unexamined assumptions. In fact, this seems to be the hallmark of distinctively philosophical problems, right? So Wittgenstein said he saw himself as having the job of showing the fly the way out of the fly bottle. And what he meant by that was that he thought philosophical problems were self-inflicted, and it could well be. And I, in fact, think that many of the issues surrounding questions about the mind and its relation to the body and so on have this self-inflicted character, that they're the product of assumptions that we're making that we regard as innocent, but in fact are causing the problem. So this is the one area in which I would agree with Wittgenstein, at least when it comes to the mind-body problem, or the problem of consciousness, or any of those.
This also relates to your new answer to what is the mind problem in general. So depending on which position you take out the two subcategories, that's obviously going to affect how you then see the possible conclusion of whether it's actually a valid question in itself. And it's true to a certain extent that a lot of the problems in philosophy are not just to do with actual definitions, but also certain assumptions you bring to the table. One of your most prominent bits of work is mental causation. So first, you talk about that in general and how that ties into the study and the contributions it can bring to philosophy of mind. And then secondly, how that also ties into, again, the mind-body problem, depending on whichever route you take to the mind-body problem. So start off with a general overview of mental causation, what it entails, and its possible consequences.
Well, if you think there's a problem about mental causation, it's because you think that there's an important distinction between what is mental and what is physical. So, and at least since the 1990s, I think the problem has been regarded as that of understanding how mental states are properties. I don't think substance dualism is much on the table nowadays, but the idea is mental states are properties. How could these be causally relevant? That's the term usually invoked here to physical behavior. So philosophers, I think, in the 80s and 90s, began to embrace what we call non-reductive physicalism. And this is the idea that mental states are not reducible, whatever that means, to physical states. And yet they somehow depend on those physical states. They arise from those physical states, as Dave Chalmers says, or others think about them as emerging from the physical states. Some people talk about mental states are realized by physical states. I've heard neuroscientists talk about the physical substrate of the mental and so on. Now, once you make the distinction, once you say, well, look, mental properties or mental states are distinct from, even though dependent on, physical states, then the question arises, okay, so how could they have effects on the things that produce them? I mean, they're not just further physical states, they're non-physical states. And how do these non-physical things, how could they possibly get a grip in the physical world? So how could your undergoing a particular conscious experience lead you to, you know, perform a particular action or move your body in a particular way? So the problem arises as soon as you make a sharp distinction between the mental and the physical. And that's where it seems to me that's the fundamental that's the fundamental mistake. That's where people have gone wrong.
What would you put on the table as a potential approach to solve this problem if you think some people have gone down an erroneous corridor? What would you put on the table as a potential solution to this? If you're saying that the sharp mental-physical divide is a problem, what would be some of your general suggestions?
So this isn't a potential solution. This is a this is a solution. So the idea is, why don't we think of abandoning non-reductive physicalism, which is a non-starter in any case, and go. I think Donald Davidson was on the right track when he said, look, the distinction between the mental and the physical is not a real distinction. It's just a distinction in the way in which we describe things. So something is mental if it can be given a mental description, a description in a familiar mental vocabulary, and something is physical if it can be described in a physical vocabulary. And then he went on to add that whatever you can describe in a mental vocabulary could be described in a physical vocabulary. So the distinction, Descartes says, look, the distinction between the mental and the physical is a real distinction. It's a genuine distinction. You're talking about two different kinds of thing here. Davidson is saying it's a distinction in conception only. It's a distinction in reason only. It's a distinction in the way in which we choose to describe things. So this isn't reductionist. You're not saying, oh, the mental really is the physical and it's not idealistic. You're not saying the physical is the mental. You're just saying the world is such that parts of it, at least, can be described in a mental vocabulary, and parts can be described in a physical vocabulary. And let me just add here that the original arguments against reductionism, the arguments that all of us accepted back in the old days, and I still accept, concerned not properties, but taxonomies or ways of talking about the world. So Fodor, Jerry Fodor's original anti-reductionist arguments and Richard Boyd's arguments in the 70s, middle and late 70s were arguments that you couldn't translate psychological or biological terminology into the terminology of fundamental physics. And that seems absolutely right to me, but nothing of interest ontologically or metaphysically follows from that. Davidson could still be right. It could still be that these are just different ways of talking about the same thing. That just seems right to me. So, and if you take that route, the problem of mental causation doesn't arise, or at least it doesn't arise in the same way.
Just two things that I want to clarify there and unpack. So essentially, on the one hand, so you've got these two opposing views on the spectrum. One of them is this reductivist approach in which all mental phenomena is reducible to purely physical aspects going on in the brain. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you would have that they are two distinct phenomena, going back to the Cartesian paradigm. But you're saying that instead of picking one side, you're not meeting them in the middle or conjoining them, but you're saying they're not one or the other. They can be both analyzed as one or the other, depending on how you're basically using this vocabulary.
Well, if you think about reduction, so what is reduction? When you reduce the A's to the B's, what are the A's and the B's? They aren't entities. It doesn't make sense to say I'm going to reduce one entity to another, unless you're making a sauce or something in a saucepan. So reduction seems to involve taxonomies or ways of describing or theories or something like that. And you can't replace one way of talking or translate one way of talking about things into another way without its following that you're talking about two different things, that you're talking about two different realms or something like that. So the idea is the best view, the view that seems to me, after being committed to it for so long, obvious, is that the mental and physical are different in conception only, different in they're not really distinct realms of being at all. They're different ways we have of describing or thinking about or encountering one and the same thing.
Essentially, they're not ontological entities. They're just
That's right.
different in terms of vocab and taxonomy, which is a great point because it leads me to this question, which essentially, when you were talking about taxonomies and earlier, you said that if we were to define mind and consciousness, then that would imply that we essentially know what mind and consciousness is, which is always an interesting factor to me in terms of definition. So the way the mental causations come up and the way you've put it forward as a solution, one thing I think is interesting in terms of the way definitions are so paramount in this discussion is if you take to a viewpoint, so someone like Donald Hoffman, who isn't a panpsychist, but he believes that a neo-idealist position, that the mind and idealism must be something prior to physicalism for the fact that there's obviously a tension between the two. Philip Goff is a student of, I believe, Galen Strawson. I'm assuming you know who Galen Strawson is. He may not, but another panpsychist philosopher. And these are the people that really push the primacy of idealism before physicalism, which would be that problem they encounter in that framework would be solvable from the area that you come up in terms of it's just a problem of vocabulary. Then you've got the other side of the argument where someone like Dan Dennett would say that this kind of problem that we have with qualia, the inner world and the subjective experience, just first and foremost is an illusion. This subjective inner experience just simply is brain states, and this is an idea also adhered to by Michael Graziano at Princeton, who was basically saying to me that the idea of an internal subjective experience is basically the byproduct of modal brain states. But both of those have problems of definitions in terms of, if you're saying that qualia and first-person subjective experience isn't an issue, then you're simply defining that away as just being the same as a physical experience. On the other side of the argument, it seems to me that if you say, oh, no, no, this problem is very profound and there is clearly a difference between the mental and the physical, then you're just also defining the mental as something by definition that's opposite to physicalism. And that seems like something that your position is saying. Is that something you would agree with? Because a lot of this just seems to me people pick their own side in terms of how they're actually defining and framing the question and the potential answers.
It absolutely depends on how you frame the question. And that's where it all goes. That's where the arguments all go. So Galen Strawson and Philip Goff, who was a student of Galen's, defend panpsychism, but Galen at least thinks of himself as a materialist. But he just thinks that material world includes experiential characteristics, so to speak, all the way down. So there's something it's like to be an electron, perhaps, or something like that. But Galen, I think, sees his position as close to the position that I'm outlining. So, and in fact, what I said is consistent in a way with what Dennett said. That so I'm saying that if I'm in a certain conscious state, that state could turn out to be a brain state that's describable using the vocabulary and explicable using the vocabulary of neuroscience. Now, the arguments against this seem to me again to be very odd. I mean, the idea is, well, wait, how could that be? Because the qualities of conscious experiences are way different from what you see when you look into the brain or what you discover when you examine the brain using instruments and so on. And I want to say, well, wait a minute. So give me an example of these qualities. And when people give examples of these, typically they talk about red sunsets. And take a simple example. So you're having a visual conscious experience of a red tomato, a ripe tomato in bright sunlight. Now, what are the qualities of your experience? Well, we describe your experience as an experience of a red tomato, but your experience isn't red. The tomato is red. Your experience isn't spherical. The tomato is spherical. So it's as though people think consciousness couldn't possibly turn out to be a brain state, because when you look at the brain, when you look at the brain of someone experiencing a red tomato, you do not see anything red and spherical shaped. But why should you? It's the tomato that's red and spherical. Why should a neuroscientist's experience of your experience of a red tomato be anything at all like your experience of a red tomato? I mean, that's hard to parse maybe, but suppose that your experience of a red tomato is an occurrence in your brain, and suppose a neuroscientist observes that, then the neuroscientist is having a perceptual experience of your experience. And why should that neuroscientist experience be anything at all, resemble your experience of the tomato? It shouldn't. So it just seems to me that that a mystery is being made here by a pernicious way of describing the circumstances. So
I think that's a valid point. I mean, it depends on the definitions. Obviously, there's a split side, but I've always thought of Galen, whichever you want to pronounce his way, as being quite a panpsychist from the stuff that I've read.
Yeah, he is, yes.
I didn't know from your perspective you could also take the other approach to it. But I mean, taking definitions aside, so you've already done a very good job of explaining why these taxonomies, the divide between the mental and the physical, isn't necessary. Obviously, if you're going to put something in the spotlight and you turn it around, you can look at it from the other end of the argument, which is quite a reasonable proposition to make. But you're saying you could also line up with the Dennett position that you do think that the brain and the mind is produced by the physical material brain.
So I wouldn't say produced by. I would say that our best hypothesis is that mental states are brain states. They're not produced. Well, I mean, so just as some brain states are produced by others, yes, mental states are produced by brain states in that sense, but they are. I'm an identity theorist, I guess, at heart here. And so I think it's misleading to say they are caused by mental states or caused by brain states. They just are brain states.
So a valid point, obviously, depends on how we're employing the term produce, and you're right to clarify one point of that. But another way we'd be saying it was the chemical substance, alcohol, produces a sensation in your mind, which is that chemical substance working the material brain. And that produces, in this respect, doesn't need to necessarily produce, but it simply is someone's subjective experience of alcohol is.
Yeah.
But yes, I see how you conflate the two, and it is one and the same. I tend to ask my guests who are specifically philosophers of mine whether they believe in zombies, but I think at this stage it's probably pointless because I pretty much know your answer. I think I do, obviously, not to speak to you, but yeah, I don't think you think they're possible. Anything else that's worth noting that you know? I think it's very important to understand if one's looking at consciousness, the mind and brain, no matter how they define it.
Yeah, so you're right. I don't believe in zombies. There's one thing that you mentioned in passing that I might just comment on, and that is the objective and subjective points of view. This is often used as one of the marks of consciousness or the mind or whatever. So the subjective point of view versus the objective point of view and so on. To me, this again confuses what it is to be in a particular state and to observe to observe someone's being in that state or to observe that state of someone or something. I mean, your refrigerator can be in the state of defrosting and you can observe that state. Observing it is not to be in it. And your observation is nothing like being in that state. So I think the subjective objective as a mark of consciousness is also needs to be re-examined. Let's put it that way.
That's an interesting point because I've heard a similar point to that. And Rosa Chow at Stanford, who, when I was speaking to her about the hard problem, was like, I don't even bother with the hard problem because that doesn't help me scientifically. I just literally focus on the stuff that we can study objectively. And that the example of the refrigerator seems quite akin to that notion as well, in terms of, well, we're not trying to get the experience of being in the state of a refrigerator, which is trying to observe the refrigerator, which is a good way to put it as well. I also think, just in general, aspects of, you know, this huge problem of first person subjectivity, it's like, I don't understand the whole problem behind it. As long as you can externally observe someone, again, there's obviously going to be philosophical notions with that in terms of what you mean by that, but as long as you can externally objectively observe something, that's okay. For example, we see animals around us, we assume that they are real and materialistic, not to get into Berkeley idealism, but they're real in front of us, and we observe that they must have, obviously, as a animal themselves with some kind of, not all animals, but most of them with some kind of nervous system, that it must have some subjective quality to it. A dog A might have some subjective quality different from dog B. It's got its own kind of subjectivity, whatever level that's on. But it really doesn't matter in terms of we just observe the dog externally and just assume that it's got one. I sometimes think this whole problem of subjective experience and qualia, my red isn't your red, is a bit, I don't know, I sometimes don't see how it aids the conversation. If you can try to study it externally objectively, that's one thing. But so what if John Hale's experience of the color yellow is slightly different from Tony's experience of the color yellow?
Yeah, I just say it would be surprising if they weren't slightly different. So,
of course, it's just for the general complexity of any kind of phenomena in general. John, what kind of research are you working on at the moment?
Well, I'm working mainly in metaphysics. So philosophy, I see philosophy of mind as applied metaphysics. So the hard work is done in the metaphysics. Then once you've sorted that out, the philosophy of mind takes care of itself. So I haven't been focusing really. I have some papers on consciousness coming out, but that's because they were invited and I somewhat reluctantly agreed to do them. But basically, I'm working on fundamental issues in metaphysics that don't pertain specifically to the mind-body problem or consciousness or those sorts of things.
What kind of metaphysics is it in general?
traditional metaphysics, not so much what we think of as analytic metaphysics, but the metaphysics I'm doing is closer to the metaphysics that was done by medievals or by early modern philosophers. It's in that genre. I see myself as continuing that tradition rather than as doing the more linguisticized stuff that I see being done by most of my colleagues who do what is typically called analytic metaphysics.